Well, I wonder if we can review a little bit before we start in. Has anything lingered in your mind on the lessons from Gideon and his band? Huh?
They stood and they shone and they shouted.
Okay. I like Howie Hendricks, doesn't it? Some of you heard him. Nancy?
I think, too, the fact that Gideon was so very human and that the Lord used his weakness to show himself mighty.
Okay. Mariana?
I think that the band not only needed a heart, but they needed skill. They needed to keep their objective in mind and not be the root.
Okay. I told you I was kind of casting about for a word. I used the word skill. Somebody suggested the word after class, vigilance. And that's a good one, isn't it? Not only a heart, but vigilance. Okay, who else had that?
Well, you were just one of the men when the battle took place, so you were just one of the guys.
All right. Donna?
Before getting to the next, you guys have a permission.
Okay. Anybody else?
Gideon's confidence sparked his plan that he had. The plan didn't sound like much, but his confidence overruled the word.
Okay. Jim?
Not only did he have a conviction and submission, but he had that commission through the promise.
All right, he was slow to accept the promise, but once he finally got it, then he lost out, didn't he? Well?
The courage inspired within the man.
That was a courageous thing to do, to walk out in the midst of at least 30,000 of them, wasn't it?
Well, there's a deal with the fact that after Gideon and his band of men had really kind of conquered the Philistines, why didn't everybody else gather in the chase and kind of follow the act?
Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Okay, anybody else?
The fact that God was already at work among the Midianites when you heard the two fellows talking about the dream that they had that they already defeated.
Okay, we call that psychological warfare. Okay. Anybody else?
We have a personal application from the idea that the pitchers were empty and were broken. He's a humble man, and that we too are empty vessels and brought by Christ who does the work.
Okay. Anybody get inspired to attend the Dale Carnegie Leadership Training Courses? All right, anything else before we go on? We have tried to kind of isolate what we're getting at. I feel like there's competition out here in the hall. But the first part of the leader. And then the second thing we wanted to emphasize was the members of the band. And we characterized the 300 as those who had both the heart and the skill for the battle. Now in this wind-up session, we're going to talk more about the ministry of the leader in the band. So as I put out my notes, here I had the chief minister, the fellow ministers, and the ministry. And we keep calling the leader, call him the leader, but really he is the chief minister among the ministers, isn't he? In any kind of warfare, the most important and the most difficult thing to do is to identify the objective and then to maintain it. So the maintenance of the objective is the most important of the eight principles of war. I told you I'd try to find that clipping.
Just take that.
The maintenance of the objective is the most important of the eight principles of war. And I'm going to enumerate those for you in just a minute. But I told you I'd read this paragraph from one of Lord Nelson's, I think I said it was Nelson the other day, but I was in the wrong service. It was the Duke of Wellington that wrote this letter. So I have a copy of it here. It was addressed to the Secretary of State for War, Lord Bradford. And he says this was written in 1810, in this letter. He says, "My Lord, if I attempted to answer the mass of futile correspondence that surrounds me, I should be debarred from all serious business of campaigning. I must remind your lordship for the last time that so long as I retain an independent position, I shall see that no officer under my command is debarred by attending to the futile dribbling of mere quill driving in your lordship's office, from attending to his first duty, which is and always has been, so to train the private men under his command that they may, without question, beat any force opposed to them in the field. I am, my lord, your obedient servant." And he signed it, Wellington. Did he know what his objective was? What was it? So train the private men under his command that they could defeat any force that opposed him in the field. The principles of war are scoffed at by some military leaders, but they are based on an analysis of all the military engagements in history. What is it which one commander has utilized in a greater measure than the other commander that has made him victorious? Now, just to kind of fix these in your mind, I'm going to read them to you here. And let's comment on to the degree to which Gideon used these things. Now, the first one, of course, the maintenance of the objective. And in warfare, the maintenance of the objective is the destruction, or the objective is the destruction of the enemy's main force. Every head of a nation in history has had difficulty, I think, with his generals and his commanders who would get their mind on a secondary objective, such as capturing real estate or attacking supply lines, things of this sort. Actually, in warfare, and we just go into this by way of background, what a commander is always trying to do is to build up superiority in any area and then attack. Now, if he cannot build up superiority in an area, his next strategy is to withdraw to where the enemy has to extend his supply lines to such a degree that he becomes superior. Then he attacks. If it is impossible for him to do either one of the two, then he has two alternatives: either to make suicide attacks or to attack the enemy's supply lines. So all military men know that when the enemy starts majoring in attacking your supply lines, that this is an admission of desperation. Now, of course, this added a new dimension in World War II when air power came along. And we thought that we were going to win the war in Europe with air power. A post-war analysis showed that only 6% of the bombs dropped by the Air Force in World War II hit their targets. And during the first 2 years of bombing of Germany, their strength increased continually. They were stronger 2 years after bombings began than before. Now, there were other factors in this. But the Germans were eventually defeated not by attacking their supply lines, but when the armies in the field came up face to face with them. Japan was a little different story there. Well, the maintenance of the objective, which is the destruction of the enemy's main force, because if you can destroy his main force, then all the rest of it just naturally falls in there. Well, the objective. Now, we're going to talk about that just a little bit in John 17. Now, as far as Gideon's concerned, what was his objective? Well, in order to deliver his nation, he had to defeat the enemy army, didn't he? Now, he used other principles in doing this, but that was it. And I think he even went after that. He didn't try to attract supply lines or occupy territory. Now, the second in the principles of war is what is called as offensive action. No enemy is ever defeated by defensive action. The devil must be out-challenged, out-maneuvered, and finally defeated by a well-thought-out attack. Then the person writing this book says the best offensive in our armory is prayer, and if it is neglected, we shall invite defeat. But offensive action. I saw an analysis of why France, which defeated the Germans or had a large part of them in World War I, fell in less than 60 days in World War II. And this documentary showed pictures of two statues to national heroes in France. The first one was the Minister of War, André Maginot, who portrayed the French philosophy between World War I and II. So he built the great Maginot Line, and the French climbed in there secure, and that was their preparation for fighting the Germans in World War II. Defensive action. The other statue pictured the leader, the hero of World War I, who was Marshal Ferdinand Foch. And as the camera played on his statue, you could see in French just four words, which were his life motto. And these words were, attack, attack, always attack. That was the difference in the two philosophies. And of course, you remember the most famous story of Foch. As they were facing the Germans in World War I, he was listening to reports, and he saw that the left flank had been turned back, and the right flank was crumbling, and the center of the line was being penetrated. So when he got these three reports almost together, he says, the situation is excellent. I shall attack. And he did, and pushed him back. So, offensive action is the second principle. Now, the third is security. Now, let's compare this with Gideon a little bit. Or rather, think about the Midianites. How was their security? He took advantage of their lack of security, didn't he? He was able to penetrate the camp. The fourth is economy of forces. Would you say that Gideon economized on his force? The fifth is cooperation. And we won't go into that. The sixth is mobility. That's the ability to move faster and farther than the enemy. The seventh, and one of the great ones, is surprise. Did Gideon employ this? The eighth is pursuit. This means to follow up an advantage once it's been gained. this was typified in what I told you the other day about Patton, who went across the bridge before it had time to blow up. How about Gideon and his men? They engaged in pursuit. They used quite a few of these, didn't they? Well, the one that we're going to have to stick with here this morning is just the first one. The maintenance of the objective as it refers to the ministry. Now, let's suppose that God has raised up a band of men. Now, what would be his objective in raising up a band? Now, don't answer me yet. And I want to use some illustrations. Let's turn to the 17th chapter of John. Those of you who are staff conference heard me comment a little bit on a spiritual highlight of the recent trip that I made around the world, 30,000 miles in 40 days. It was a day and a night in Jerusalem. And I had just one thing in mind, which I've had for years, and that was to spend the night in the Garden of Gethsemane. So I have planned and plotted this for a long time. So when Nate Mercer and I went over after doing what we wanted to do in the daytime, went down to the Garden of Gethsemane about 9 o'clock in the evening, took a flashlight, made sure it had new batteries in it, so we could read and pray all night long if we felt we should. Well, we got down there and we did read, and we prayed. And then we had a time of silent meditation. We each went our own ways. And, of course, what we read and meditated on most was the 17th chapter of John. I don't think I'm particularly emotional by nature, but this was a very wonderful experience to be there and to read aloud John 17, realizing that we were within a few yards of where the Christ had actually uttered these words in a different language, of course. As you look at the 17th chapter of John, we find reveal Christ's objective for the band. Now let's see if we can get a clue to this, starting with verse 5. I have a circle around the word world in my Bible. In the verse 9, here it is again. I pray for them, I pray not for the world. Verse 9, well, that was 9, wasn't it? Verse 11, twice. And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. Verse 12, while I was with them in the world. Verse 13, I speak in the world. Verse 14, three times. The world hath hated them. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Verse 15, world again. 16, world appears twice. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Verse 18, same word twice. As thou hast sent me into the world, even so I have sent them into the world. Verse 21, that the world may believe. Verse 23, that the world may know. Verse 24, before the foundation of the world. Verse 25, O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee. Now, actually, this word world appears in here 18 times in this verse, in this chapter, and in verse 4, in the verse earth appears in the same context. Now, if you didn't have any other guide to kind of judge what was the chief subject matter of the 17th chapter of John, what would you conclude from this repetition? You've already concluded something. What do you conclude? Bob?
He's interested in the world.
Okay. has occupied a prominent part in his thought and vocabulary on the last few hours that he had on earth. Now, verse 25, I think, is the real climax of his burden. And as Nate and I read this 23rd verse there in the Garden of Gethsemane and meditated on it, I think the Lord did something to both of us. I just realized that almost the last words that he said is, "O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee." Now, does this give any clue as to the objective of the ministry? What do you think? You've heard it expressed in other ways, but from John 17, what would you say that his objective was? The world might know. Now, this would be the purpose of a band, wouldn't it? Of men, that the world may know. Well, we're real glad that he not only had an objective, but he had a plan for this also. And, of course, we're interested in the band becoming involved in the plan. Several years ago here at the rodeo, the local committee imported Dale Robertson, who I believe at that time was a star of Wells Fargo, Tales of Wells Fargo. And everybody expected him to really rip out some good old Western. But the song that he sang in every performance, and that was really stole the show out there, was, "He holds the whole world in his hand." Scotty and I were in a conference together a few weeks after this, and Scotty remarked, he said, "Well, I'm sure this is true, but there's another greater truth that can come out of this song, and that is that he holds the whole world in his heart." And I've tried to get Jeanine Field to add this song to her repertoire and change it a little bit into saying that he holds the whole universe in his hand, but that he holds the whole world in his heart. This is true, or he wouldn't have mentioned the world 18 times, I think, in his last prayer. Now, what I'd like to add to this, that he holds the plan in his hand also for this being accomplished. And it's revealed in John 17, I think, better than any place else, and is a clue to what we're talking about here this morning. Let's look back at verse 4. Second phrase in there. "I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do." Now, had Christ been crucified yet when he uttered these words? A little bit later in John 19:25, he said, "It is finished." That was redemption. But here he said, "I've finished the work that you gave me to do." Now, I suppose we could get a whole blackboard full of suggestions here as to what the work was. And we'll select them out of here, right out of the, not out of speculation, but right out of the book here. In verse 6, I think we get the first clue. He says, "The man which thou gavest me." In verse 11, he says, "Those thou gavest me." And in verse 12, he again said the same thing. "Those that thou gavest me." Now we begin to get a little clue here. This is repetition. You're all way ahead of me here. But in talking about how a group is supposed to operate, we've got to stick to Scripture here, not necessarily come up with anything new. I have finished the work that you gave me to do. And this work started with the men that thou gavest me. And as you read the Gospel of Mark, Mark moves right into the essentials as quick as he can. You haven't gone many verses until he said to Peter and Andrew, follow me. He said to James and John, you follow me. He said to Levi, you follow me. He began to gather them up. All right. The men thou gavest me. Now, verse 6. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me. I looked this up in two or three other translations, and the Amplified said, I have revealed your very self, your real self. And the Phillips says about the same thing. So here's number one. He finished the work, which was to take a group of men that God had given him. The first thing was to manifest himself to them. Now, I'm not sure these come in order. In verse 8, he says, I have given them the words which thou gavest me. And the same thing is in verse 14, verses 8 and 14. In verse 9, he said, I pray for them. And if we would run through that, which we might do a little bit later, we'll find four requests that he had. Well, we might as well run through them. Verse 15, he prayed they'd be kept. Verse 13, he prayed that his joy might be fulfilled in them. Verse 17, he prayed that they would be set apart. And verse 21, he prayed for their unity. Unity. In verse 17, he said, sanctify them. I was talking to my class of high schoolers yesterday, and this matter of sanctification came up. And I asked them, what was the most sanctified article that they owned? And some of them said their Bible, and some of them said this, that, and the other. And I said, no, you missed it. The most sanctified article that you possess is your toothbrush. Because it's something that is set apart for your personal use. It's a very personal possession, isn't it? I don't suppose you'd mind sharing with somebody if they'd like to have it, but I'm not sure you'd want it back after. Of course, there's exceptions to this. In our household, we have constant complaints about somebody using someone else's toothbrush. I was out Pearl Harbor on December 7th, and our routine was a little bit disrupted there in the next two or three days. And a buddy of mine got hold of a toothbrush before I did. Our ship had been sunk. And he offered it to me. And I accepted with gratitude about the third day. And his razor, too, after Pearl Harbor. But generally speaking, this is what sanctifies, something that's set apart for your personal use. So a sanctified person is one who is set apart for the personal use of Christ, isn't it? Well, those are the four things that he prayed for. Now, in verse 18, he said, as you sent me, I sent them. So there are four things here that he did with the men that had been given to him. He manifested the name of the Father. He gave them the words. He prayed for them. And he sent them. Now, I'd like for us to speculate a little bit here as to how the plan worked. How did it work in the first century? Well, let's take a look at Colossians 1, I think it's 6, and verse 23. Now, you people have got other versions in the King James. Just hold back a little bit here, will you? I personally think that the translators were a little afraid of what was said in the original. A little afraid of it. Colossians 1, 5, and 6. He's speaking the word of the truth of the gospel, which has come unto you as it is in all the world, and bringeth forth fruit as it doth also in you. Now, to what extent geographically was the gospel effective in the first century? According to this verse, all the world. Now let's look at verse 23. If ye continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which ye have heard, and which was preached to every creature, where? It is under heaven. You believe that? Or would you like to take another translation and say, well, potentially, preacher is available, everybody. Or Colossians 1:6, some of them translate it, which is being spread into the whole world. It's a little bit stronger. Well, let's see if we can water this one down. Acts 1:5. I guess I mean 2:5, yeah. 2:5, not 1:5. Day of Pentecost. And there were dwelling at Jerusalem Jews, devout men, from all the neighboring countries. What's it say? Every nation under heaven. Now, just how the American Indian got represented over there, I'm not sure. Because Bernard Ram and his cohorts say that at the very minimum, he's 8,000 years old. And there's strong evidence to believe that he's 30,000 years old. Well, I don't know, but I've got to make a choice between this and the exact science by which the age of the various peoples are reached. Well, let's go into secular history for a little bit. Even in the 3rd century after Christ, Tertullian, I think that's the way you pronounce it, on the witness stand for his faith, about to be martyred, early in the 3rd century. And on the witness stand, he just casually made the remark about the type of citizenship that the Christians were. And he said, although we are in the majority in almost every city, we have still lived lives that are models of good citizenship. The word's not enough. Now, why do you think he would make a statement like that? Why would he? Because it was true and everybody knew it. I think that's the reason he said that. This wasn't any great mystery to anybody. He just wanted to... The Christians were being accused of being such poor citizens, opposing a government and everything. And he said, well, although we're in the majority, we haven't taken over, tried to throw out the government or rule. In Rome... I know some of you visited Rome. Joe, I know you have. Probably run up and down the catacombs there. Actually, the population of Rome at the time of Christ was probably greater than it is today. And because of that, real estate was at a great premium, as it may become in some of our cities someday. So they never used the surface of the ground for cemeteries, but always just dug underground. And if you ever walk through the catacombs, you'll see how they just dig out a hole, go down, and when it's time to bury somebody, then they just dig a little more dirt out, extend the tunnel a little bit, carve a little shelf off, lay the coffin up there. Of course, there's many of them still up there as you go in the catacombs. The network of the catacombs is almost 200 miles and extends completely under the city. First time I was in Rome, I just told a taxi driver I wanted to visit the catacombs. He said, which one? Was it more than one? Was it more than one? He said there were, I think, I forgot how many entrances he said you could enter, but 75 or 80. But the whole network, 200 miles. Now, during the persecutions right after Christ, the population of Rome decreased by about 20% as they moved into the catacombs above ground. So even in a wicked city like Rome, immediately 20% of the population was identified with the Christians. And I didn't check Leroy to see where he got this quotation from. He used it on at staff conference of a writer of the first century who said there isn't a nation on earth where the prayers are not offered up in the name of Jesus Christ. First century writer. Well, the question was, how did the plan work? How do you think it worked? The plan that Christ had of taking a band of men, he did four things for them. And the last, of course, is in verse 18. He sent them. How did it work? How's the thrust of Christianity working today?
January.
I was taking care of some business back in Washington, just actually down the State Department, getting some final information before I went over to Europe. I walked back to the place where I was staying. It was kind of cold that January day. When I walked past the Department of Commerce, I'd lived in Washington for 2.5 years, but never been in it. I saw a sign open to public, walk in. And I thought, well, at least it'd be warmer in there than it is out here. So I walked in. As I walked in, I saw this huge board that looked like a pinball machine, tipped up on end, only went through the ceiling. It had lights, red and green lights, and dials turning, and bells and buzzers and everything. I thought, what in the world is this? So as I read the caption on it, it said the estimated population of the United States. And then as you read down, and saw the lights and the dials and so forth, it says there's a birth in the United States every 10.5 seconds. That's pretty frequently, isn't it? There is a death every, I think I better check the notebook, I think it's every 17 seconds. I wrote this down as I walked out. Every 19 seconds. There is an immigrant enters the country every 90 seconds. I didn't realize it was that great. I don't know whether that counts the wetbacks or not. A person emigrates, leaves the United States every 23 minutes. This gives a net gain. The birth of the U.S. every 7.5 seconds. Now, when you boil this all down, the net gain in population of the U.S. is 1 each 10.5 seconds. So when I walked out of there, the big dial says the population of the United States was 185,319,209. which was about a half a dozen more than it had been when I walked in. The United States of America has about 1/16 of the world's population. Our birth and death rate are not quite the average of the entire world, but they're close enough for figuring. Now, if you want to do a little bit more mathematics, you'll find that we have a daily increase of population in the U.S. of about 8,000 per day. 8,000 more people here than were yesterday. Now, if you multiply this by 16, you will get in excess of 135,000 more people here than in the earth than were yesterday. If these people were going to live the way we live in Colorado Springs, it would take about three cities the size of Colorado Springs every day, have to be built every day, just to accommodate them. Now, why do I mention this?
The plan that's being used today
not only is not making any inroad into the population, but isn't touching the second-by-second increase. In Tertullian's day, he said that we're a majority in every city. The NAE has compiled some statistics that indicates that the born-again population of the world today is about 1.7. Instead of being the majority, over
50%. 1.7%
of the world's population are born again people. Less than 2%. And if you just want to check that against the local situation, just check the block in which you live. Maybe a little higher, but world over, that's about what it is. Now, all this is, according to the NAE, this is people that there's a reasonable belief to believe that they're born again. But the United States alone has over 100 million church members. Now, I can't vouch for this, but the NAE came up with this. I think it's a pretty good statistic. Well, how did Christ's plan work the first century, second and third? Worked pretty well. So in the ministry of the group, you know this as well as I do, that we probably need to get back to the scriptural plan. No. Now with this in mind, with this little background, and we can throw some other figures around here, which we may do before we get through, I think we will take one other figure at this point. If God were to give Billy Graham the privilege of being used to bring 1,000 souls a day to Christ, assuming there were no Christians in the world, how long would it take him to reach the world if the population remained static? Didn't even move. Well, I'll let you do some figuring on this. It would be about 7,000 years. Everything just sat still and waited. Lee came around, 1,000 a day. I do not know to what extent you're in agreement with Bishop Usher's chronology of the Bible, but according to Bishop Usher's chronology, if Adam were living on the earth today, how old would he be? He'd be under 7,000, wouldn't he? Now, you see, Billy Graham would be older than Adam if Adam were still living when he got the job done. 1,000 a day. Now, let me tell you another story. My home state is Missouri. And among other things that my home state is known for is mules. I don't see so many of those back there anymore when I go back, but it used to be quite an industry. In fact, one of my ancestors was in the business, and he needed some ready cash one day, so he loaded up a couple of carloads and sent them down to Kansas City. Well, he didn't have any daily newspaper or radio to see how the market was going, so he found out that everybody had had the same idea about the same time when the market was flooded. In fact, he wasn't offered enough money to pay the railroad company for freighting them down there. Well, of course, he couldn't ship them back home very well because that would have been a loss. He couldn't afford to, but it even had been a good idea. So he told the buyer, he said, let's make a sporting proposition here. He said, I can see that I have come down the wrong time. I've got 30 mules in these two cars. Now, if you give me $1 for the first one, 2 for the second, 4 for the third one, 8 for the fourth one, so on up to 30, you can have them. So the buyer said, okay, I'll take them. Now, they shook hands on them. Then they sat down to figure out the bill. Well, you know what happened. That there wasn't enough money in Kansas City to pay for just the 30th mule. Because he would have been worth $2,800,000,000. Now, why do I use these figures? What is the population of the earth, the estimated population? 3.2. We hear various estimates. It's really going up. By 1980, it'll be double what it is now. 6 billion. But it's not much over. It's somewhere in here between 2.8 and 3.2 in here. So you see, one Christian, Billy Graham, 7,000 years through addition. One Christian, 30 years, multiplying once a year. This figure of 1.7 will give us approximately 55 million born-again people in the world today. If they could just be organized into a few bands of people that would start reproducing and multiplying, provided this was the method the Holy Spirit wanted to use, the world could be reached in our generation. Could, on this basis, could be evangelized, I should say, in our generation. Now, we're not dictating the Holy Spirit how to do His work. But the Scripture seems pretty clear on discipleship. And it just sort of seems logical that if He can get disciples, He'll use them. And He is concerned about the scarcity of laborers, isn't He? Well, this might all fit together somehow. Well, I've taken an awful lot of time in order for us to try to arrive at the objective of the band's ministry. And the second half of what we're going to talk about here will be how to accomplish these things that Christ accomplished in His band. Now, what would you say the objective of the band is? Right, but certainly the world is involved, isn't it?
To train and reproduce the priests.
I expect we're all agreed on that. The maintenance of the objective. Very difficult, isn't it? The Southern Baptists are probably the most prolific group of people in the world today. Their objective for the United States is to establish 10 churches per day. Right now. They have some 30,000 churches in the United States. That's what they're working at, 10 days. I was talking to one of their leaders a while back, and he acknowledged, even with this ambitious program, they cannot keep pace with the increase in population of the United States, much less do a good job in evangelism. I was in Hawaii a while back when the Southern Baptists were having their 10th anniversary in the islands, having established nearly 100 churches and with 75 paid workers at that time. Southern Baptists have got more workers in Hawaii than the Navigators have got in the world. But at that time, they sat down and analyzed the rate of reproduction and found that they had exactly doubled in the 10 years, which meant that every member of the Hawaii Baptist Convention had reproduced himself church membership-wise once during the 10 years. And as the head of the convention was pointing us out to me, I told him, I said, you know, this is amazing. I just read in the paper a couple of days ago that this is the national average in the United States. A church member getting another church member once for 10 years. This is the rate at which our churches are growing in membership, not Christians. Well, so much for the mathematics. I'm sorry that this hasn't been a more orderly presentation. And all I can say is that if you think this is disorganized, like I said the other day, you should have seen my notes I threw away.